You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The American dream of owning a home dates all the way back to the Homestead Act of 1862, when the government gave millions of acres away to farmers across the country. The 2008 financial collapse had some of its roots in that tradition of encouraging widespread home ownership. In The End of Wall Street, best-selling author and former Wall Street Journal reporter Roger Lowenstein explores how this ideal went awry, leaving millions of Americans under the threat of losing their homes. It's published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Roger Lowenstein to our show today. Hi.
Len, always a pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on the great reviews this book has.
Thank you.
Was there a period during the financial crisis when you actually had the thought, this is the end of Wall Street?
You know, there really was. I think it was a week or two after Lehman. And just to refresh listeners, Hank Paulson, the Secretary of Treasury, had bailed out Fannie and Freddie. That didn't stop the bleeding. Then he said, well, I'll take the other tack. I'll let Lehman fail. Maybe the market needs a good, healthy dose of, you know, realism. That didn't stop the bleeding. He goes back to bailouts with AIG, and things continue to melt down. Then into the next week, as Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley seem to be on the edge, money market funds are freezing, and companies like General Electric can't get credit. You felt like maybe they're going to grass it over, and we're not going to trade stocks anymore. And I wanted to evoke that feeling in the title.
So when did you realize that it wasn't the end?
In the second week of October, Hank Paulson did a very important thing. Everything the government had been doing was about trying to add liquidity to banks, buying mortgages from them, creating new windows at the Fed where banks could borrow. But there's an old saying, a bankrupt can't borrow their way to solvency. In the second week of October, Paulson said they had already passed the TARP. He said, I'm going to use it in a different way. Instead of using it to buy mortgages, I'm going to invest capital, the government's capital, your capital, my capital, in banks, partially socialize the banking system. And I think that really decelerated the crisis and was the beginning of the recovery.
And that was during the Bush administration, even though people are now saying that Barack Obama is the man who's trying to socialize everything.
Yes, I called that chapter about Hank Paulson the reluctant socialist, because he is a rib-rop Republican and had no desire to. And people, as you say, forget that it wasn't Obama. It was these Republicans who did it.
But what would have happened if Wall Street had ended? Wouldn't we just have to relocate our financial center to another street like LaSalle Street in Chicago?
Yeah, you know, it gets inconvenient if you can't use a credit. I don't think LaSalle Street would have been doing very well, if that's a literal question, Len. But, you know, if you can't use a credit card because no one is going to finance it, if, of course, you can't get a mortgage. You know, Wall Street does some good things, and then there are all these companies that presumably are making, inventing products that need capital. So Wall Street isn't just about outrageous fees.
But we did have the Depression, and people lost confidence in Wall Street, and then they gained confidence again.
It took a generation.
You think that's what's going to happen this time?
I think for our generation, we've had sort of a shock. And are we ever really going to think that bankers don't need to be told where their limits are? I think in all these sorts of ways, government's going to come back, has come back, and will stay back.
So when it was dying, like when Lehman Brothers died, was that an entirely bad thing?
You know, I don't think it was. I think that was Paulson's view, with a lot of people's views, that if banks take risks, they ought to pay the price for it. And I was happy at the time, and many people were happy. They've forgotten since then. But let Lehman take the fall for it.
Well, Lehman really did some egregious things. But do you think that the crisis served as a kind of forest fire, getting rid of the unnecessary and dangerous practices that were happening there?
They certainly did for now. I mean, nobody is getting 100% financing mortgages. Financing of Wall Street, leverage on Wall Street is way down. Mortgage-backed securities aren't as exotic as they were. The question is really is what is the Congress going to do, really beginning next week, when they finally tackle, now that health care reform is passed, financial reform?
Chris Dodd's bill. Huge bill, which is unlikely to look anything like it is finished.
I have a problem with these huge bills that try to do so many things. They want to create a systemic risk, a regulator who's going to watch out and see if there's systemic risk. Then there's going to be another body that's going to protect consumers. They're all over the place. If I were running the zoo, I'd have one or two hopefully very effective simple fixes. And the first one, I know you want to know what my first fix is going to be. Every time we get into real bad trouble, it's because banks are over-leveraged. I would put a limit. You can't play 30-1, leverage.
We've given them a lot of slack in the past.
They have all the slack they want. There are no limits. Lehman had, we knew they had 30-1 leverage, based on which means obviously they're playing with $30 of other people's money, borrowed money for each dollar of their own. Based on what's come out in the last few weeks, apparently their numbers weren't even honest, so the leverage was even greater. Same thing with Bear Stearns.
So they were being kept alive artificially.
They were not being straight with the street, so some of their people were lending to them who might not have lent to them had they realized that they were in deeper water than they admitted.
Although they were also not in the too-big-to-fail category.
That's another thing with this idea of, in the Dodd bill says, we're going to create a systemic risk regulator, which is going to decide which institutions are systemically important. You never know ahead of time. Nobody 3 years ago was worried about Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns or some little financial product subsidiary of an insurance firm. I mean, AIG's derivatives group in London. That wasn't on anybody's radar. When trouble hits, there really are no advance warnings. And if the wise men in Washington couldn't predict it last time, I don't have a lot of confidence that they'll do better next time.
Until the Dodd bill winds up being enacted in whatever form it winds up, have any new practices or regulations been instituted to ensure that something like this won't happen again?
Well, yes, in two ways, really in a regulatory way, not a legislative way. Bank regulators are tougher right now.
Following the old rules?
They're putting their thumb on the banks. They're looking at the quality of assets more towards the old rules. You can't go in now and say, I'd like an 80% mortgage and I'd like the other 20% in a second mortgage, and I didn't really bring my documents along with me, but trust me, which is what people were doing. That kind of mortgage is out. So that change has happened for now. Mary Shapiro, the chairwoman of the SEC, said something very interesting, which is an SEC proposal, which would become a code if it's adopted, which is she wants to take the credit rating agencies out of the formal process of vetting mortgage-backed securities. At the end of the day, why did all these banks make these terrible loans? Because they were selling them to investors. Why did investors buy them? Because the agencies put AAA stamp on them. And that would be a huge change to take them out of the loop.
My guest is Roger Lowenstein. His latest book, The End of Wall Street, is published by Penguin. Well, what about those rating agencies? Why did they do it? Was it faulty math, or was it simply that they didn't want to rile the companies that were paying them to stay in business?
Well, all of that. Let's go back a sec. In the old days of rating agencies, when what they were rating was a bond, let's say Ford Motor, they'd put out an opinion on Ford, and if some investor wanted to know what Ford's credit was like, they would pay Moody's or S&P. So Moody's and S&P knew that it was in their interest to put out a good critical piece of research. That's how they got paid for their research. In about the 1970s, that system changed, and they began to be paid by the issuer. So now Ford came to them. Ford wanted to be rated, so Ford would pay them for the rating. The same thing was true with Merrill Lynch and people who issued mortgage-backed bonds. There's a big difference between those two steps. If you're investing, let's again use the example of Ford, the rating's nice, but you can read the published financials and pretty much figure it out. They got plants all over Dearborn. They're competing with GM and Toyota. We know what their debt is, and you can come to your own opinion about what the credit is worth. If you're buying a bond backed by 2,000 mortgages, short of going door-to-door in Southern California and Phoenix, you have no idea, okay? So you're really dependent on the credit rating agencies. The agencies are paid by Merrill Lynch, Lehman, and the other securitizers. There are only a handful of them. There aren't thousands and thousands of mortgage securities. So each of these clients is very important to the rating agencies. And the way the system worked, and it's sort of, you're going to blanch when you hear this, but a Merrill Lynch would go to Moody's. if it liked the rating, it would pay for it. It would buy it. If not, you know, as if it's at Bloomingdale's, it will go next door to Saks. It would go to S&P.
So there was an incentive for Moody's to give them a good rating.
Well, in the book, I say it's as if you had three taverns side by side, free to set the drinking age, each of them. You'd have 9-year-olds downing bourbon. I mean, this is, you know, you have a race to the bottom in standards. And this was a huge contributing cause to the
bust. So there was just a lot of rubber stamping.
There was rubber stamping, and there was collusion, and there was corruption.
Well, how has the measurement of risk changed since the possibility of a nationwide mortgage collapse is no longer unprecedented?
Well, since then, there's been very few mortgage securities issued. The market has almost wholly slowed down, stopped. The only people really buying mortgages right now are the government. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Ginnie Mae by about 90% of all mortgages. The interesting thing to see is as the private market creeps back, what kind of risks are people going to take?
Now, most people are saying that this crisis began with the failure of Lehman Brothers. At least that's when we became really aware of it. You say it goes back a lot earlier.
Yeah, you know, I started out the same way. My first title, working title, actually, was 6 Days That Shook the World. And a week later, I called my editor and said, I think we should make this 2 Weeks That Shook the World because it's still shaking. But the more I got into it, the more I realized that it really wasn't just about Lehman. It was about a whole ethos, a generation of loose credit endorsed by Alan Greenspan, but certainly carried out enthusiastically by banks and mortgage organizations, by American consumers who borrowed more, went into debt, and so on. By the time that Lehman happened, the foreclosure rate was already up 4 times. Delinquencies were setting records. Unemployment had been rising for 9 months in a row. The country was already in a crisis, and Lehman was, you know, the wake-up call.
Well, Greenspan has been criticized for having too much confidence in theory. Was that a problem?
Yeah, I think it was. It's not just in theory. He was just instinctively opposed to interfering in markets. To Greenspan, markets were as if derived from heaven or the Garden of Eden. They were, you know, as if they arose in a state of pure nature, and he didn't want to sully them. He just couldn't bring himself to admit that markets could make mistakes too.
Now, you're a journalist who was at the Wall Street Journal. You probably a lot more sophisticated about all this stuff than someone like me. How come you weren't noticing that something was wrong?
Well, you know, Ben Bernanke said, and I'll lead into myself, it was a subprime problem, okay? And a lot of people missed that although the initial problem began with subprime loans, and those are loans that go to borrowers with lesser credit, those loans were being bought up by all the big banks, Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, et cetera, around the country. So unless you were looking at the balance sheets of those banks and realizing that it was really more than a subprime problem because, you know, every bank in the country was stocked up in them, and they were so eager for them that they began inventing bonds that had they ran out of actual mortgage bonds, and they had to create fictitious bonds for all the people who wanted them.
Do you then give Bob Rubin a little slack when he testified yesterday that there was no reason that he could know what was going on?
I'm appalled. Bob Rubin was the chairman of the executive committee of the board of Citigroup. It was his job to know what was going on. It was particularly his job because he was brought over after he left Treasury without a particular responsibility. He was the great watcher of risk, the master of uncertainty, as the title of his book is. If not Bob Rubin to watch over these issues, who would? And his letters to the shareholders were full of this flowery prose about uncertainties. But, you know, here was the biggest uncertainty of all looming in his own bank. I don't understand how we can say he didn't know.
My guest is Roger Lowenstein, who reported for the Wall Street Journal for over a decade. He's now a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and other publications. His fifth book is The End of Wall Street. It is published by Penguin. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Roger Lowenstein. His latest book, The End of Wall Street, is published by Penguin. And a listener called in to suggest what many people have suggested, that the initial problem was when Glass-Steagall was repealed.
Well, Glass-Steagall, of course, was the act that was passed in the 30s to keep investment banks and commercial banks from being run out of the same shop. The reason actually was interesting. Citibank was buying bonds from Peru, which it knew to be basically worthless. And then when little old ladies and so on came into their branches in New York and other places, it would convince them to put their deposits into their savings, into these Peruvian bonds.
This is in the 30s?
This is in the 30s.
Well, it wasn't called Citibank then, but...
No, it was First City or whatever it was, National City, but... this was in the 20s, and then Glass-Steagall stopped it.
And they didn't. People weren't thrown in jail for that?
No, because there are no laws. That's why they had to pass the laws. I mean, the head of a chemical bank was shorting his own stock. You could do. It was great if you ran a bank in those days. You could do anything. And the old
sounds like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, the old expression that there ought to be a law. I mean, this is what it comes from. So Glass-Steagall. In the late 90s, commercial banks began to push to get back into investment banking and insurance, in particular Citigroup. And at the behest of Bob Rubin, who was then Secretary of Treasury, with the strong urging of Rubin, the Clinton administration finally did away with Glass-Steagall. The regulators were asleep at a lot of switches in this episode. I don't think that was the most important switch. There was, at the same time, and many of the same people, got very active in making sure the Congress or regulators didn't regulate derivatives. And that, to me, was a much bigger slip-up. And Rubin, Greenspan, Larry Summers ganged up on poor Brooksley Bourne, who ran an agency called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, to make sure that they didn't regulate derivatives. I think that had more to do with this crisis.
Well, but in the end, that was all about the same sort of thing, like selling worthless Peruvian mining stock.
Yes, it was.
And the subprime mortgage rates, are all connected with that. Again, Peruvian mining stocks.
Well, in this case, we didn't have Peruvian mining stocks. We had CDOs. And if you think about these CDOs, where do they trade? Nobody knows. They trade in some drawer. They trade, undercover between two bankers. And what Brooksley Bourne was suggesting back in 1998 was, let's put them on an exchange. People trade copper futures, they're a derivative. People trade wheat futures, they're a derivative. But they're out in broad daylight, and exchange clears them. They know the size of the positions, so we don't have to worry about it. And she was run out of town.
Getting back to the whole business of subprime mortgage, is there a better way to help people with poor credit histories get homes? Because people will still want to own their own homes.
This is a very tough problem because it's very double-edged. You want people to own their own homes. You want to help them. But the fact is that if you help someone to purchase a home that they can't afford, you're really not helping them, and you're not helping the countries. We've learned also that one of the big characters in the book, Angelo Mozilla, went on a crusade. Of course, he was the head of Countrywide Savings, saying that every American ought to have a home. And it sounds great. It was like a chicken in every pot. He said even people who don't put any capital in ought to have a home. And that sounds great too. Free homes for everybody. But who's going to pay the bank back? And people who had no capital in their homes had no stake in them. In many cases, they were committing fraud. Some people were buying two, three, four mortgages at once and flipping them. The capitalism doesn't work without capital.
Well, in the past, the government had gotten into this act, hadn't it? Had it withdrawn from it?
No, the government was very much involved beginning in the 30s when it set up Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac. In the Johnson administration, it changed its tack. And what happened was, every time that Fannie Mae bought a mortgage, and Fannie Mae was an agency of the government, it went on the books. And there was a lot of expenditure going in the books back then because LBJ was fighting the Vietnam War, funding the Great Society. So he said, let's get Fannie Mae out of the government. We'll privatize it. It'll still do the same thing, buy up mortgages. Everyone will still know the government's behind it, but I won't have the, Congress nipping at my heels about the deficit anymore. And this went on, and Fannie Mae got bigger and bigger, as did its twin, Freddie Mac, under this arrangement. Since people knew that the government was behind it, they were willing to lend it basically unlimited amounts of money. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, since they also had private shareholders, they were competing to earn profits. So they, because of competition, they got bigger and bigger. They borrowed more and more. There were no market checks on them because people figured it's safe to lend on them. And they became this, these monstrosities with $4 trillion in debt that came tumbling down.
Well, we've also been on a credit binge. And to some degree to a large degree, that's been financed by other countries. So how much of an international impact did all of this have?
Well, the international influence was very great, and it's interesting that you bring that up because people have been worried about the balance of payments deficit for some time.
And some people are worried that China may not be as generous as it has been in the past.
Yes, or just choose to invest someplace else. As far back as the early 2000s, people were saying, we're living off the credit of China and of other countries in Asia. And a very influential economist by the name of Ben Bernanke wrote in 2005, he was not yet Fed chairman, it's really okay. This is healthy. There's a savings glut in these countries in Asia, and we have a need for capital. So naturally, capital is flowing from east to west. He recognized in that same paper that this was distorting housing prices, and he said so. For some reason, that didn't raise alarm bells at the Fed.
Are the usual countries continuing to lend to us now that we have a poor credit history?
Well, we can assume they are, but not so willingly, because if you've noticed lately, the interest rate that the U.S. government's paying for long-term bonds used to be about 2%. It's now 4%. So somebody's charging us more. Somebody's a little less willing to lend.
Has the financial market always been such an important part of the American economy? I mean, for New York, for example, we used to have manufacturing. We had a whole bunch of other things. Now, to a large degree, we live and die by what's going on in Wall Street.
No, that's a good observation. We've really had a financialization of the economy, and the mortgage market's a good example. In certainly our grandfathers' days, if you went and got a mortgage, you know, the banker looked you up and down, decided you were a good credit risk, lent you the money, and kept it in his drawer for 30 years, you know, until you had that party and burned it. Now, you get the mortgage an hour and a half later. He sells it to some securitizer. The securitizer bundles it with maybe 2,000 other mortgages. They sell bonds against it. Those bonds get rebundled. So there are all these added financial steps that are sort of the latticework behind what is the same single step in the mainstream economy. Getting the mortgage.
Why did banks put themselves in situations where they jeopardized their own capital?
Well, you know, that's a really good question.
I mean, that goes against the whole capitalist tenet of self-interest.
Yes, it does. I mean, the capitalist tenet of self-interest is that you can trust bankers to look out for their own hide. That's Adam Smith. That's the invisible hand. Part of it is, you know, there was a saying at Lehman Brothers that we're in the moving business. We're not in the storage business. And what that meant is, we have all these securities on our books, but when we need to, we'll move them out, okay? We're not storing them. So everybody thought they could get out before the party stopped. In fact, Chuck Prince, we talked about Bob Rubin. Chuck Prince was the chairman of Citigroup. He said, as long as the music's playing, we have to keep dancing, okay? Now, you know, any child of six knows that in a game of musical chairs, not everybody's going to get a seat when the music stops. And for some reason, these sophisticated bankers thought they would all be the ones to get out.
Well, it's also because the government put faith in them.
Yes. I mean, Alan Greenspan said derivative transactions negotiated by private bankers do not need regulation. And I'd say it was the prevailing view on Wall Street that you don't need to tell a banker not to lend too much money. It's in his self-interest not to lend too much money. I think that's one of the things we've learned.
My guest is Roger Lowenstein. His latest book is called The End of Wall Street. It's published by Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why did the collapse of Lehman cause a domino effect that led to so many calamities in one week?
Well, a few things. You know, as Lehman was failing, and as you recall, it happened over a weekend, the Fed and the Treasury were working around the clock to, as they put it, put foam on the runway so there would be, not a panic. They tried to make sure that all of Lehman's counterparties, the people that it did business with, were paid or at least somehow prepared for this. But they, you know, you can't control every aspect of an auto accident. There's always going to be some spark that flies. One of the sparks that flew was in the money market industry. Money markets had bought Lehman paper. That is to say, people invest in money markets to get a return. And what do the money markets do with that money? They buy bonds. And the prevailing belief is that money markets are as good as money in the bank. They're sacrosanct. It turned out that a few money markets had put their savings into Lehman Brothers. There was a panic out of money funds. That was really akin to the banking panics in the 1930s. And that really precipitated a credit system meltdown.
Well, we talked about what happened at Lehman earlier this week with another guest. And one of the things that came up is that Lehman had been in near-death situations before.
Yes, that's, you know, you can learn the wrong lesson if you survive too often. And I think Dick Fuld, who ran Lehman, was a guy who had survived so many times that he thought it was his birthright. And I think that's why, because Hank Paulson and others were telling him for many months, some people even more than a year beforehand, you should sell the firm, Dick. You know, you've taken it far. Don't skate too close to the edge.
How has this crisis affected the relationship between the Fed and Wall Street, especially in the light of the fact that so many people go from one to the other?
Well, the Fed is now the 999-pound gorilla. You know, coming into this crisis, we had five investment firms, Morgan Stanley, Goldman, Bear Stearns, Lehman, that weren't regulated by the Fed. They were regulated by the SEC. You know, Merrill's been merged out of existence. Lehman, and so has Bear. Lehman doesn't exist. And Morgan Stanley and Goldman are now commercial banks regulated by the Fed. So we have fewer banks, and I'm afraid they're much cozier with the Fed. Fewer banks, they're bigger banks. And, you know, does the Fed consider them to be too big to fail and therefore under its wing? You know, that would be the appearance, and it's certainly very distressing.
Do you think that this whole thing indicates an ideological shortcoming in our system?
Yes.
A failure of practice?
I think both. I mean, I think we had a tremendous ideological failure when we thought that markets could regulate themselves. You know, we don't leave it to drivers to set their own speed limits. We shouldn't leave it to bankers.
But a listener points out that Glass-Steagall was canceled in order to compete with Europe, which doesn't have a separation between the two types of banks.
Yeah, I don't think Glass-Steagall was the big deal here. I mean, the SEC made a decision in 2004 to loosen leverage restrictions on investment banks. I think that was a terrible decision. The decision I talked about earlier when the various regulators decided not to allow regulation of derivatives. John Dugan, the comptroller of the currency, one of the top banking regulators of the country, came to the Fed in 2004 and said, we have to stop these subprime mortgages. They're getting out of hand. The Fed didn't want to do it. You know, I think these were all tremendous regulatory failures. They had nothing to do with Glass-Steagall and nothing to do with Europe.
Should the Fed move to model itself more like, to be more like the overseas central banks?
In one sense, yes. You know, Greenspan was...
Because they restrain speculation.
Yes, yes. Greenspan and Bernanke is fond of saying, it's not our job to prick asset bubbles. You know, we just watch inflation. We don't interfere when the stock market gets too high. In Europe, they do. And I don't know why the Fed here thinks that they shouldn't intervene. The damage that these bubbles do when they inflate and burst is tremendous. And actually, Bill Dudley, the head of the New York Fed, has said now, you know, we really have to be proactive. I'm waiting for Bernanke to say it, too. I think the Fed should model itself more like the European banks.
You said earlier when I mentioned the 1,300 pages of Chris Dodd's proposal to change things, to regulate the financial system, that you'd had little faith in those huge omnibus bills. If you were writing legislation, where would you start?
You know, the first thing I would do is put some limits on banks, and the limits I would put on is how much they could borrow. Every crisis we've had that's been so terrible, done so much damage, has involved banks over their heads in debt, up to their necks in debt. You could say, for instance, no bank can borrow more than 15 times its capital, and to the extent that they do, put a surtax on them so they're paying an insurance premium. Just as we'd say to a smoker, you're a risk to yourself and others, we would say to a bank with 18 times leverage, you're a risk to yourself and to the economy. And you know, something with teeth. The Dodd bill addresses leverage, but there are no hard limits. The House bill has...
Have you read all 1,300 pages?
I'm up to about 200, 300, you know. The House bill mentions the 15-to-1 limit, but only for institutions that are deemed systemically important, whatever they are. And I would like to see everybody be hit with a leverage limit. I think that one fix would do a lot than a lot of these other things put together.
On another matter, you provide a cast of characters in the opening of your book, and it seems like you've listed about 100 people. Only 5 of them are women. Do you think that this needs to be addressed in reforms?
Well, I'm just thinking about what I'm going to say to my wife when she hears that question. You know, Wall Street is still a pretty male-dominated place.
And some people say that if more women were in positions of power, it would be different. We have a former producer who went to work on Wall Street. She said, well, you know, the women who rise to positions of power are just as ruthless as the men.
You know, I do think there was something in the anecdote that I tell about Brooksley Bourne, who was just run over by these four powerful men. I do think there was sort of a sexist element in that. In fact, Bob Rubin lectured her on what the law was. Brooksley Bourne had been editor of the Stanford Law Review. She didn't need any lectures. You know, I think in general we need more good bankers, men, women, or what have you.
And what that's led to, that feeling, is outrage over the kinds of bonuses we're still seeing being handed out.
Well, there's a fix that, you know, that we really could use, and neither of the bills goes far enough. One of them has say on pay, so shareholders could vote and say, we're happy or unhappy. Well, big deal. Bankers aren't going to not take their bonuses because shareholders say they're unhappy. We should have mandatory say on pay. No CEO should collect his bonus unless his shareholders have approved. It's their money. We don't get paid unless our bosses approve of our salaries. The same should be true for these guys.
And there was a time
when... And they are guys, as you point out.
There was a time when these kinds of inordinate bonuses were not the norm. That's something that's only happened more recently. It seems like the reaction on Wall Street is, well, this is the norm, and that's just the way business is conducted.
Yeah, I think, you know, bankers now, this has been going on for 10, 15 years, they really do have something of an inflated sense of their own self-worth to think that, well, $10 million is an average year, you know, $20 million is an average year. And if you leave, it was interesting to me that when Chuck Prince was fired from Citi, having presided over probably the greatest capital destruction of any financial firm in history, in addition to the bonuses that he was locked into contractually, the board awarded him $12 million more. And that's a rather large payment for somebody who's been a colossal failure. And
I can only hope that happens when they fire me here.
To journalists and writers, you bet. You bet.
Roger Lowenstein's latest book is called The End of Wall Street. It is published by Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It was a real pleasure to be on the show.